Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm your host, Lydia Johnson. This week, we'll speak with Illinois Congresswoman Nikki Baczynski about the future of the Farm Bill and a potential compromise on year-round E15. But first, here are this week's headlines. Former House Ag Committee Chairman David Scott of Georgia died on Tuesday at the age of 80. Scott was a staunch advocate of nutrition assistance programs and the USDA 1890 Scholarships Program during his 23 years in Congress. He was running for re-election for a 13th term in the House. Scott was the first Georgian and the first African-American to be chairman of the House Ag Committee. Scott's death marks the fifth vacancy in the lower chamber, placing the margins at 218 Republicans and 212 Democrats. The Farm Bill is set to get a vote in the full House next week. Before that, it must go through the Rules Committee on Monday. Numerous amendments have been submitted, including some seeking to remove controversial provisions to overturn California's Proposition 12 animal welfare standard and language to protect pesticide manufacturers from lawsuits. An amendment was even submitted to authorize year-round sales of E15 and the latest compromise by lawmakers to appease both oil refiners and ag groups. The Farm Bill advanced through the House Ag Committee in March on a 34-17 vote with the support of all Republicans and 7 Democrats. House Ag Committee Chair G.T. Thompson told AgriPulse he expects at least 10 more Democrats to support the measure in the full House. There is pushback from some fiscal hawk Freedom Caucus Republicans, but Thompson remains confident there's enough support for the measure. I asked Illinois Congresswoman Nikki Baczynski what she makes of the Farm Bill and the process the committee has gone through to bring it this far.
Yeah, I mean, I am paying very close attention to where we are right now with the Farm Bill, having it moved out of committee, but now we're in the amendment process. I've put forward a number of amendments that I think will make the Farm Bill a better, stronger Farm Bill. And so as we're moving through that amendment process, I'd highlight one key amendment in particular is adding my support to a bipartisan measure to make year-round E15 a reality, finally, for our growers in the Midwest. Joining with a number of my Democratic and Republican colleagues in that amendment, very anxious to see whether that will be included in the Farm Bill, but a number of other kind of key provisions. I've been critical of this Farm Bill as it is currently drafted as it relates to SNAP, not adjusting for the time that states need for additional time for implementation, let alone the cuts that were made in general that was back in the reconciliation package HR1. There were no adjustments for SNAP in this Farm Bill language or base text. I also have some concern around some privatization measures within SNAP administration. Those are merit positions and potentially moving them away from being merit positions to privatized positions. So I have an amendment on that as well. And then fertilizer, also amendment on young and beginning farmers. So there's a whole host, I think, of opportunities that I've introduced. We had our deadline yesterday for amendments that I think will make this Farm Bill stronger and something that I'm going to take into serious consideration as I'm determining what I'm going to be doing on final passage.
Yeah, and I want to circle back to that year-round E15 amendment. I mean, you've been a big champion of that all the way through, and this issue, it seems like, has been so close to the finish line so many times. But as we saw this amendment, the text come out, you know, refiners have had a lot of pushback on that as well. But ag groups have been generally supportive. So I'm curious if you think it can still move forward with the pushback from those refiners, those stakeholders, and those oil state lawmakers.
Yeah, I'm very optimistic. We've been in negotiation. It feels a little bit like Groundhog Day. You know, we've been in these negotiations to landing the plane around, you know, what's best for our growers, but also what works for the large, medium, and small refineries. I think there were some minor adjustments made for the small refiners to help them out a little bit more from previous legislation that had been introduced on year-round E15. So that's reflected in the amendment that I joined. But, you know, look, I think year-round E15 is a bipartisan issue. We've been working on it through the waiver process, not perfect, but in essence, we have kind of gotten eventually to this year-round E15 using waivers. What we want is certainty for our growers. That's what year-round E15 provides to our growers back home, in particular in the Midwest. And with all of the uncertainty right now in the farm economy, we think now is the time to make sure that we're delivering on this.
We'll be back with more Newsmakers right after this.
As a cooperative, our customers are our owners. They share our profits and help guide our business. We're not just another lender. We're Farm Credit, and we're here for you.
I think some of sustainability to farmers just comes second nature. If you asked a farmer, are you sustainable, they'd probably look at you maybe a little funny and say, I don't think I'm doing anything that special, but it really is just what they do. We're all farmers, and our goal is taking the best care of our land, our cattle, our natural resources.
This
is my sustainability story.
Welcome back. Chairman Thompson says the Farm Bill is expected to be teed up for a floor vote next week and says he's confident nearly 20 Democrats will vote in favor. I asked Illinois Congresswoman Nikki Baczynski if she plans to vote for the Farm Bill and how many Democrats she thinks could support it.
I came to Congress in 2022 talking about getting a farm bill done, a bipartisan farm bill done. I want to see that cross the finish line, but I will say I'm going to be paying very close attention to the amendments that I highlighted, whether they're related to year-round E15. In particular, I have another amendment called the Fertilizer Transparency Act that would help us to really quantify more data around accessibility, utilization of fertilizer for our growers. I have some other amendments that I'm going to be paying attention to before I make a final determination on passage. I think those amendments make for a stronger farm bill. And they're going to support our growers in particular. And I want a farm bill that does just that. So I haven't made a decision. I know a lot of our we've had Democratic colleagues come out in strong opposition to the farm bill. I know in committee we had a number of Democrats that did support the farm bill coming out of markup. So we'll see what happens next week and what happens in the Rules Committee.
Yeah, and also in the agriculture space, you know, farmers are beginning to hit the field to plant, maybe in the field right now, but they're seeing very high fuel and fertilizer costs due to the conflict in Iran. So, yeah, I'm curious, you know, first, you know, what concerns you most about that conflict? And also noticed that you signed on to that Homegrown Fertilizer Act this week. But broadly, what policy changes are really needed to support specifically, you know, fertilizer as we move into the future so the farmers have what they need, as much as they need, and at an affordable price?
Well, look, I think we need more domestic fertilizer, sourced obviously right here. I think that will insulate us from what we're seeing in the Strait of Hormuz when fertilizer, such a significant amount of our fertilizer actually moves through the Strait. We've seen an upwards of 70% increase in cost of fertilizer because of the war in Iran and because of that choke point in our supply chain as it relates to fertilizer. It's why I did sign on to the Homegrown Fertilizer Act with Congressman Eric Sorensen. That's an amendment that we've submitted for the farm bill as well that I'm paying attention to. You know, basically what it would do is President Biden had set aside last Congress about $900 million of investment in domestic fertilizer manufacturing, coming up with a grant program that would help to incentivize more domestic sourced fertilizer. Unfortunately, this administration has halted that program. We did hear from Secretary Rollins when she testified in front of the Appropriations Committee earlier this week that she was very open to bringing back that grant program. So again, I think those are the kind of things that I think would help our growers, help us create more, bring home more of that supply chain here that will then insulate us from what we're seeing in the war in Iran and escalating fertilizer costs for our growers.
We'll be back with more newsmakers, but first, Andrew Hennecke looks at U.S. beef cattle inventory, and this week's Map It Out.
The American cattle herd is shrinking, according to USDA's most recent cattle inventory report from January. With the smaller herd size and such high demand, you may have noticed prices for ground beef skyrocketing at the grocery store. This map shows the most recent numbers for the country's beef cow herd by state. The report estimates the beef cow herd at 27.6 million head, which would be the smallest herd since 1961, according to the American Farm Bureau Federation. Most states have anywhere from 200,000 to 400,000 head, while some states are still up over 1 million, with Texas leading the way at over 4 million. The report predicted all cattle and calves at 86.2 million head, which was the lowest in 75 years, according to the American Farm Bureau Federation, which means we would be in the eighth straight year of a shrinking herd. For AgriPulse, I'm Andrew Hennecke.
I've worked at Coca-Cola for 21 years.
We're delivering Dr. Pepper for my branded facility in Dallas, Texas.
We're really proud to still make Pepsi products in America.
You don't need a college degree to work here, but I put 4 kids through college by working here.
This is a great place to work with great people and great American brands.
Grocery stores, convenience stores, restaurants, they all depend on us.
We deliver great paying jobs.
We deliver beverages people love.
We deliver for our community.
For 35 years, soybean farmers have invested together to build demand for U.S. soy at home and around the world. Through the Soy Checkoff, farmers turn every dollar into stronger markets for U.S. soybeans, driving innovation and partnerships across feed, food, fuel, sustainable production, and beyond, led by farmers and built to last. U.S. Soy, 35 years of delivering value back to the farm and investing in the future of agriculture.
Welcome back. Farmers are going into planting season with exceptionally high fuel and fertilizer costs that many farmers did not pre-book. I asked John Newton with the American Farm Bureau Federation, what's most concerning about the situation?
Well, I mean, since it started at the beginning of March, we've seen prices for fertilizer and diesel fuel increase significantly. I think urea prices are up over 50% probably at this point. Same thing on diesel prices. Anhydrous ammonia prices are also starting to accelerate. And like you said, it's happening at the worst time for farmers because planting season is underway across much of the country. And, you know, I think what we wanted to do with our survey, because there's really no good data on, you know, how many farmers pre-book fertilizer, and to understand the impact on the farm economy and the risks that farmers are having right now, we asked our members, you know, how many of you pre-booked fertilizer? How many of you have concerns on fertilizer affordability through the remainder of the growing season? And in 9 days, we had close to 6,000 responses, which is just, it tells you the urgency of what's happening in rural America when you have that many responses. And what we found, you know, in the Corn Belt, where it's a corn-soybean rotation and those farmers know what they're doing each and every year, they had higher levels of pre-booking. But in the South, where there's much more uncertainty, there's a much more diverse crop rotation, I believe their pre-booking percentage was around 19%. But unanimously, I think 70% of the respondents said, we're gonna have challenges buying the fertilizer we need for this growing season.
Yeah, when you look at that data, especially, you know, those regional differences, how do you see farmers as a role in the field? I mean, we saw this conflict begin early February, early this year, but change their planning decisions based on the repercussions of fuel, fertilizer, and everything else across the supply chain.
Sounds like we might need to do another survey. You know, I think the reality is we had the March intentions report that revealed about 95 million acres of corn was intended to be planted. Obviously, that can change. We won't know until we get the June acreage report from USDA how these acreage decisions may have changed due to the rise in fertilizer prices. I often get asked the question, what about yields? We won't really know the impact on yields until the crop emerges, we start seeing the crop conditions reports, and then we get the first objective yield survey in September. So I think there's still a lot left to unfold as this growing season continues to see what the impact is on corn, soybeans, cotton, wheat, rice, all the major crops.
Yeah, and we've seen economists say that, you know, if run a number of scenarios, but say these fertilizer prices still could very well be elevated in 2028. You know, I'm curious from the policy perspective, I mean, what really needs to be done? We've heard, you know, talking about, you know, increasing domestic fertilizer production, mm-hmm. potentially even, you know, a bank fertilizer here in the U.S. But from a policy perspective, what really needs to be looked at or done into the future?
Well, I think first and foremost, I mean, we are seeing the policy conversation start to accelerate. There are a number of bills that are floating around in the fertilizer space. But I think an important part of this conversation, we need to have hearings. We need to get experts at the table. We need to get economists and industry representatives to help us think strategically on how do we, in the short run and in the long run, solve this problem. Because with so much of the world's fertilizer moving through the Strait of Hormuz, we're not really food secure if we have to import in so much. I believe we import about 25% of our fertilizer needs in March and April, right as planting gets underway. So I think it's part of a larger strategic conversation. But at the same time, and we've been talking to the White House and talking to Congress, President Duvall visited with Ranking Member Craig even this week to talk about the need for economic assistance, because with these fertilizer prices going up, with diesel prices going up, the only thing that's going to help a farmer right now is additional economic support.
Yeah, and let's dive into that a bit more. I mean, lawmakers have gone back and forth. Chairman Thompson floating a figure as big as $20 billion, $10 billion for row crops, $10 billion for specialty crops. I mean, do you think lawmakers can really get on board with another one of these packages? I mean, we just saw one in December, but could they get on board with another one and one that of that size?
I certainly think they could. I mean, the president at the event at the White House back in March said we need to support farmers in the next spending package, whether that's an ag disaster supplemental or some other vehicle. You know, it needs to happen, and it needs to happen soon, because, you know, farmers working with their lenders need to know what's coming as they're working with them, evaluating their working capital situation. So I think it can be done. There's certainly, when Chairman Thompson's talking about it, when Senator Bozeman's talking about it, Senator Hovind's talking about it, I know Senator Thune's talked about it, the president's talked about it, Ranking Member Craig's talked about it. You have enough people talking about the need in agriculture, I think it can get done.
Yeah, and Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins is, you know, last year was talking about, you know, this golden age of American agriculture where these payments aren't necessary. So, mm-hmm. you know, I'm curious, there's a lot of moving factors and, you know, wanting to get to, from her vision, you know, a market that works by itself. But,
Absolutely.
You know, is that still possible? And when could that be possible?
I mean, that needs to happen. And I think, again, we talked about the strategic thinking around fertilizer. We need to think about that on a lot of things here at home. How are we supporting agriculture? How are we supporting domestic consumption of U.S. agricultural products, whether that's more fruits and vegetables that are raised here in the United States that are in our schools, in our grocery stores, whether that's year-round E15. And President Duvall testified in the Senate. Senator Bozeman had a hearing on how can we boost domestic consumption of U.S. agricultural products. The Buy American Cotton Act is another great example. But we need to do that, because I can tell you, farmers don't want to go to Capitol Hill and don't want to go to the White House and ask for a check. But the input costs have really skyrocketed. I think we've seen a historic increase in input costs since 2021, and we can't outbushel this problem. So we need to find solutions.
We'll be back with more newsmakers right after this.
I've worked at Coca-Cola for 21 years.
We're delivering Dr. Pepper from our branded facility in Dallas, Texas.
We're really proud to still make Pepsi products in America.
You don't need a college degree to work here, but I put 4 kids through college by working here.
This is a great place to work with great people and great American brands.
Grocery stores, convenience stores, restaurants, they all depend on us.
We deliver great paying jobs.
We deliver beverages people love.
We deliver for our community.
America never stops. Thanks to the financial support of Farm Credit, neither do the farmers and ranchers who call her home. Since the beginning, we've been helping rural America show the world what hard work can achieve. But the job is far from over. And as rural America grows further, we'll be there.
Welcome back. The U.S.-Mexico border remains closed to cattle imports as New World screwworm has been detected less than 100 miles from the U.S. border. Dr. Ellen Hart with the Animal Health Institute joined the show to provide an update on the situation.
New World screwworm is scary. We've watched it slowly creep closer and closer to the southern border. As a veterinarian, vet school at Texas A&M, we learned about it in school as something that was a distant memory and that I don't think any of us thought we would see today. But here we are, and it has been creeping closer to our southern border. And it is very rewarding to see how much work everybody has been putting in to try and make sure we are prepared if and when we get it. The collaboration across a variety of different stakeholders, whether that is producers and veterinarians in Texas, at the federal level, what FDA, USDA, and others are doing, veterinarians across the board, it's all been very rewarding to see how collectively we can come together to make sure that we are prepared as we can be for something we hoped we'd never see again.
Yeah, when you talk about, you know, the pest being scary, that's maybe an understatement, you know, that really flesh-eating parasite that we really don't want to see back here in the U.S. But can you tell us a bit more about those drugs? I mean, we've seen a number of them come across for, you know, emergency use approval and some other things. But, you know, where do you see the technology right now? Obviously, we don't want it here in the U.S., but, you know, if it does here, what preventative and treatment options are available right now?
So there are a variety of different options out there. And I will take a step back and say that I think, you know, Health and Human Services and FDA deserve a big round of applause for prioritizing this work from the FDA point of view last summer. This is the first time that FDA has ever used emergency use authorities and authorizations for animal drugs. So this is a first ever. And their ability to work quickly with the animal drug sponsors who have equally invested in a maybe. I think the story we see now as the fly has creeped closer to our southern border is a little bit of a different perspective than even what it looked like a year ago when we were looking at hundreds of miles. And investing in that maybe where there might not be return on investment and FDA investing in that maybe and preparedness, I think everybody deserves a huge round of applause for just investing in that ahead of time, because I think as it's creeped closer, the case for that becomes more and more clear. Because the best case scenario is we never have to use these products. And that's the challenge of prevention, right? Is being prepared, but also recognizing that success looks like a lot of investment in something that we never have to use. And I will just mention, so far there are 6 emergency use authorization products out there, as well as 3 conditional approvals. And work is ongoing between the regulatory side, as well as with industry stakeholders to continue filling out that toolbox, because we know the work isn't done, as you said, and I kind of alluded to, this fly can affect a lot of different species. And so that is a challenge for everybody to make sure there are sufficient tools in the toolbox so that producers and veterinarians have what they need if and when we get screwworm.
Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins has put quite a bit of focus on this as well. She put forward a plan and was recently in Texas breaking ground on a sterile fly production facility. And there's a lot of components to the response and preparation for New World screwworm, but can you explain the sterile fly technique and how it really pairs with some of the authorizations that you mentioned for those drugs?
While we have these tools in our toolbox, and hopefully that toolbox continues to expand in the animal drug space, eradication is going to depend on those sterile flies, right? We have these tools to help veterinarians and producers keep their animals safe. But at the end of the day, that sterile fly is the silver bullet. And on a very basic level, those sterile flies go out and mate and don't produce offspring. And so that's kind of the fundamental of how those sterile flies go out and reduce the population down to hopefully 0 at some point. So it's a great question. You can't overstate the importance of the sterile flies because they are the eradication tool. These drugs are just part of the toolbox to help veterinarians and producers, like I said, keep those animals safety while the sterile flies get ramped up and hopefully push this thing back south.
We'll be back with more newsmakers, but first, Andrew Hinkey looks at U.S. peanut consumption trends in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
When it comes to eating peanuts, American consumers love peanut butter. This chart shows the different types of peanut products that Americans eat. According to USDA, peanut butter accounts for more than 60% of all peanuts eaten in the U.S. Peanut production reached a record 6.5 billion pounds in 2024-2025, which is 25% higher over a 10-year span, according to USDA. For AgriPulse, I'm Andrew Hunneke.
Register now for the 2026 AgriPulse Food and Ag Issue Summit in California. The event will offer participants a full day of presentations and panel discussions. You can hear from members of the California Legislature, food and agriculture leaders, along with industry experts and academics. The summit takes place June 2nd in Sacramento. See the latest information and register today under the Events tab at agripulse.com.
I was kind of known as the sheep guy around here. The fire went from north to south and it blew that way and it went straight down the house. Lost all of our sheep literally a week before we were to start lambing. And I was really in a bad place. I happened to notice this farm state of mind piece of paper. And I picked up my cell phone and I made a phone call, and that was the best phone call in my life. I'm glad that I'm still here. So don't do something permanent over a temporary situation.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Both the House and Senate will be in session next week. The Rules Committee is set to take up the Farm Bill on Monday, with a vote in the full House on the Farm Bill possible before Thursday. For AgriPulse, I'm Lydia Johnson. Thanks for watching.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more. For agriculture, trade, food, environment, and regulatory news, your source is AgriPulse.com.